When you find a deal on your favorite thing in the McDonald's app and order it, does that technically count as online shopping? Save money with the app. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
At participating McDonald's, prices may vary.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code POD to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code POD at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code POD.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Tales from the Booth, round two. We had our first round mailbag a couple days ago, so everything I talk about on this show is going to be about the last 2 days of action at Roland Garros. Tales from the Booth. I've been calling matches in the morning somewhat for TC Plus. I say somewhat because it's been a very, very strange first week. And as a result, the Tales from the Booth is not going to feature that many Tales from the Booth. And the reason for that is I haven't called that much tennis in the last, not just 2 days, but the last 3 days, because I've been coming in the morning and the mornings have been rainy. Each and every morning has been rainy. It's been insane. Not ideal. You know, pretty annoying as a commentator, because the hard parts of the job are the preparation and the sleep deprivation. Those are the hard parts. The fun part of the job is calling tennis matches. I've gotten a lot of the hard part. I have not gotten any really of the fun part. There's been two matches that I've done from start to finish in the last 2 days. It was Petra Martic against Kiki Mladenovic and Grigor Dimitrov against Fabian Marozsán. I did some of Volynets versus Vondrousova. And of those three matches, I think, you know, the only one that I'm going to really talk about is Dimitrov Marozsán, because I just don't see there being much interest in the other two. And Volynets Vondrousova, I didn't really do the third set, so it's kind of pointless. But we have had an enormous match go down, and that's Iga Świątek and Naomi Osaka. And I'm going to spend the longest amount of time talking about that, because it was remarkable. And it's not often a second round match feels that big, that important, gets that many people excited and buzzing. And that's certainly what it was. Then there have been a lot of smaller storylines, some petty off the court stuff, and a lot of matches that I'm going to run through shortly. But first, this won't be that short. Świątek versus Osaka. Got to be careful crowning the match of the year in May, huh? I mean, I, for the purpose of titling my Świątek Sabalenka Madrid final analysis, I said match of the year, WTA match of the year, parentheses, probably. So I at least had the foresight to cover my bases. Not everybody had that. Got to be careful crowning the match of the year in May. I preferred this match. I preferred Świątek Osaka second round Roland Garros to the Madrid final with Sabalenka, just because I thought this was more juicy storylines wise. So it felt like there was more on the line. It was almost a truly stunning upset, but also acknowledging that Osaka, from an ability standpoint, is far above the class or the grade of being someone who could pull off a, quote, stunning upset. I mean, it's Naomi Osaka, four-time major champion we're talking about here. But the reason I preferred this match, I thought it was more interesting than Madrid, was not only the storylines and the circumstances around it, and of course it being a major, but also because there were all these twists and turns that I found really enjoyable. And I usually prefer that to a match where the level might be high the whole time, but there just aren't really shifts in the match. It's more of a monochrome match. And I thought this was more of the former, where it pulled you in different directions as we kind of went on. And a pretty rare set of circumstances here for a second round match to feature such a high level, such an immense amount of talent on the court in a second round match, and it delivering in this way. it was also kind of weird because you spent most of the match, at least I did. I'll just speak for myself. I was watching the match mostly mesmerized by Osaka and everything she was doing. And even after the match, I found myself thinking about Osaka and everything that she did. And then it's like, well, wait, Iga Swiatek won the tennis match. So how is it that so much headspace is taken up by Osaka? And I think it's a little bit about expectation, right? The fact that Iga, this is par for the course, Roland Garros title favorite. I think part of it is the play style that Naomi brings to the table. The serve is the closest thing we've seen to Serena. She is by far my favorite female player to watch serve easily. And I said that about Kyrgios the other day, and I think for Osaka, she'd be my WTA pick for that. Both ground strokes are just nuclear, and she was hitting them so clean, absolute BBs, time and time again. And those weapons were firing, but there was also other stuff that was a little bit more surprising. I think Osaka's sliding looked really good. I think she looked really quick for the first time all year. She ended up having quite a bit of success with slice defense. Iga did a really bad job at times of attacking those slower floating balls, and Osaka, her anticipation was really good, so she was actually able to turn a lot of points around. But the biggest thing for Naomi was mental. There's no doubt that that was kind of item number one when you were watching the match, and that's where Osaka really looked like a different player than we've seen, not just so far this year, but even if you go back to kind of the year before she stepped away from the sport for a while. Naomi was energetic between points. She was pumping herself up. And she was really, really resilient in a way that just wouldn't have been possible for her when she was kind of going dark on herself really quickly, which was kind of a bad quality that she had for quite a long time. I mean, one example, in the first set, she lost 12 points in a row. And I just noticed on the 13th point that she won, so she snapped the streak of 12 points in a row, she yelled, "Come on." Like, she was like, "All right, let's go. Let's do it." Not at all discouraged by what had happened on the previous 12 points. And she was just like, "Okay, I'm still here. I'm still here." And she came back. She went down 3-1 with that run of points by Iga. But she ended up getting herself back in the set and doing so by coming back from a down 40-love situation at 4-3. Stayed locked in, made every ball. Suddenly, Iga hit three awful forehands, didn't finish some short balls, and Osaka was back in the set. So somebody who loses 12 points in a row, somebody who's down 40 love, down a break on a return game, somebody who lost the first set tiebreak and then came out and played a great game to start the second, that's not a person who gets easily dejected or easily discouraged or goes dark on herself, which are all things that I would have said about Osaka. And in this match, there was no hint of that. Her mental performance was incredible. And then I'm going to leave it at that with Osaka. Let's talk about the outcome, right? So all these things are kind of front of mind for Osaka's performance, but why did Swiatek win the match? Well, to me, this was a nerve management loss by Naomi. And I'll get to Iga. I'll get to the part where I'm going to give her credit. That's very well-deserved credit. And I'm going to mean every word of it. But I have to be honest, and I know it sounds crazy and it sounds kind of disrespectful for someone who's won Roland Garros three times, but Osaka had this match on her racket. She played well enough to win. She had everything lined up. And if she just maintained her level, there is nothing Iga was going to do to stop it. Osaka was probably one shot away from winning the match 4 or 5 times. And I'm not talking about she was 1 point away. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking she was one shot away. And I'm not talking about a low percentage shot. I'm talking about high percentage looks, good offensive looks that she just couldn't land. And I don't know, you know, in the 5 or 6 that I'm thinking of, maybe she would have needed 1, maybe she would have needed 2, but I'm looking at 6 points that she lost, and these are shots she was making all match long. And clearly the tension just got the better of her. It was a nerve management loss. So let me go through these points real quick. 1-4, add out. So this is a point for 5-1. Osaka would have served for the match at 5-1 in the third. And she hits a nice backhand cross court to build. Iga goes back cross court. Ball is short, attackable. And Osaka puts the backhand down the line in the net. She short-armed it. She didn't finish the swing. Clearly, this was one of the examples where you could just look at her body and what it did and see how the tension just stripped her ability to hit the shot like she was all match long. So that was a point for 5-1. And Iga holds for 4-2. Osaka holds easily for 5-2. Now Naomi is a game away. Let's talk about this, this 5-2 game. Well, she's got 15-30. She was actually up love 30, but I won't say she blew a love 30 lead because Świątek on the love 30 point came up with brilliance. So let's throw that point in the window. And I'll just say that from 15-30, Osaka made three unforced errors in a row to lose that game. She was 2 points away from the match at that point, up 15-30, and she made three unforced errors in a row. Now Osaka serves for it at 5-3. And this is kind of the game that everybody is talking about as far as missed opportunities go. I would say it runs a lot deeper than that. I would not ignore the previous opportunities that she had before this point. But she's up 30-15. This is the one that everybody is really talking about because she hits a great wide serve. She has a short floating return. She has a forehand down the line. A little bit inside outy, but you know, kind of in between down the line and inside out, way inside the court. She has Iga running the other way, thinking that it's going cross court, and Osaka nets that forehand that was not coming back. It was a clear and obvious winner, would have given her double match point. And I feel like that's kind of overshadowed some of the points to follow because at 30 all, Osaka hit a great backhand cross court angle, and Świątek made a dig out of her backhand. Again, the down the line is open on the Osaka backhand. The backhand down the line is open. She's hit a great angle to open up the court, and she hits this next backhand down the line long. I think that if it landed, I think that was also going to be a winner. So she had two winners lined up and didn't land either of them. And it was a weak enough ball to change direction on because you know I'm a stickler for shot selection, especially when you're redirecting the ball. And if this was bad shot selection by Osaka, I would not hesitate to call it out. It wasn't bad shot selection. It was perfect shot selection. And she was just missing. Last 2 points of the game. So that game ends up going a deuce. Last 2 points of the game, she hit two good first serves. She got two short returns. She missed two backhand plus one balls, attacks. And that's how she ended up losing the game. Now, she did have a match point in the game. This was more on the Świątek good end of things where, Osaka did miss her first serve by 6 feet, but then Iga hit a great backhand cross-court return, and it forced the error. The only thing that I thought was weird about that is Osaka was taking her backhand down the line in a clear defensive position, and that was totally a bizarre choice for me because she was basically automatically going to lose the point by going down the line. If she made the shot, Świątek surely would have knocked down a forehand cross-court winner easily. So instead, she missed the shot, and it didn't come to that. Okay, so now we're at 5-4, and Osaka gets the game to deuce. And I'm only going to talk about one more point, because at deuce, so she's 2 points away again from winning, she hits a great return, deep middle. She hits a great forehand inside out. She's building up the pressure. She produces a weak ball in the middle of the court and pulls the forehand cross-court wide. Another unforced error, another ball that was there for her to attack. And, come on now. I mean, this was a nerve management loss for Osaka and the tennis she was executing throughout the match. She just couldn't execute under pressure. And that's what it came down to, period. Now, it's also really important to give Iga credit because this is a way I see the best players win all the time. And I've talked about it countless times over the years with Nadal and Djokovic and Murray especially, Federer a little bit less so, I'm going to leave him out of that. But Iga went full lockdown mode down the stretch. And the way she reduced her errors in the final, 8 or 9 games of the match was truly something to give a lot of props for. edge. You know, she was going to make Osaka hit that final winner no matter what. And if you do that in moments where the scoreboard is creating an enormous amount of pressure, it's going to work out for you a lot of the time. If you get super stingy, give away nothing, and let that scoreboard beat your opponent. I mean, especially when you're as fast as Swiatek, your court coverage is going to help you be a little bit more effective in that style because you're going to make a couple of extra balls, which Iga did. She was excellent defensively. Not that she was neutralizing the points, but she was kind of making Osaka hit an extra ball and Naomi was missing for her. So Iga deserves a lot of credit for that. And I also think the most underrated part of Swiatek's game right now is how many free points she's getting, which also came into play in the third set down the stretch. The serve by Swiatek, it's clearly fast enough, especially going into the body, where she's getting quite a few free points. And I think that that has mattered a lot in a lot of the biggest matches she's played recently, including that Madrid final against Sabalenka. So the two takes I'm seeing a lot after this match is, one, Osaka is officially a U.S. Open title contender, and I totally agree with that one. And I felt before the year, like, I actually thought it would happen quicker than this for Osaka. I didn't think it would take her half the year to kind of get into range like this, but I think the mental aspect for her, I think it took her a little while to have a match where she comes out on a court against a top player and says, you know what, I can win this, I'm here to win this, I expect to win this, let's effing go, and just come out with a ton of positivity and energy mentally. And that's what I think has been missing for most of the year. And also, it looks like she's in much better shape now than what she started the year with. So those have been the two keys. I totally agree. Like, this performance, it was such a stock-up performance for Osaka. And I'm absolutely thinking, look out for the grass, look out for the hard court, because she's going to be awesome. And she's still young, and you don't lose talent. You just don't. And her talent is vastly superior to 99% of the tour. You don't lose that. The other take I have been seeing is that Swiatek is more likely to win Roland Garros now. And, like, look, I thought she was going to win RG before that match happened. I think she's going to win RG after that match happened. I just want to point out one thing about the notion that, like, this seals the deal for her as far as winning Roland Garros. And what I would mostly say is, everybody said that at Wimbledon last year, like when she had that escape against Belinda Bencic in the fourth round, and it was a total Houdini act. I just want to point that out. You know, everyone was like, okay, well, now she's going to win Wimbledon because she's kind of gotten that tight match out of the way. So I don't necessarily think that Iga getting out of that situation is necessarily going to have any effect on what she does the rest of the way at Roland Garros. And then the last thing I want to talk about.
This episode brought to you by Progressive. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity. Much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save over $775 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the home gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $779 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states.
Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. See ebaymotors.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Out with this match, it's kind of the crowd storyline. You know, first of all, it sucks that the stands were so empty. That's what happens, though, when you have three matches on one ticket in a huge stadium. You cannot expect everybody to stay for 9 hours. You just can't. There's going to be people who show up at 11 a.m. and come dinner time, they're going to be out of gas and they're going to leave. Like that. That's a part of this. I just think the U.S. Open has a much better method. It's not flawless, and I think that there are tweaks to be had for the way the U.S. Open does things. Maybe potentially moving the night session up 1 hour, I think, would be a welcome change for the U.S. Open if I were in charge. But they undoubtedly have a better method than Roland Garros, because the U.S. Open, they put two sessions on the day, they put two sessions on the night, and as a result, instead of being left with one session that's too short and one session that's too long. And that's what Roland Garros has right now. The U.S. Open has two sessions that are appropriately lengthed. I think Australia too, right? I think so. I don't want to just say like it's the U.S. Open if Australia does it too, but I'm just not positive. And then Iga was upset with the crowd for being too noisy at times as well. But we're going to get to that later. I'm going to talk about the alcohol ban. Let me go through some quick hitters now. First of all, Djokovic, he's through to the third round. Now, on paper, I said this in the preview, and it's kind of played out this way, I think, in a lot of ways. But the draw couldn't have been better for Djokovic in the first two rounds with Pierre Hugues-Humbert, who really lacks a lot of confidence in the big moments and just isn't on a good run whatsoever on the clay. Anyways, you know, he's struggling against players ranked in the 200s and needed a wild card. And then Roberto Carballes Baena, who is a player who I have an enormous amount of respect for, but I think he's like the poster boy of players who top players would love to play in the first two rounds, because he's not going to hurt you. He's going to give you a lot of rhythm. He's almost going to play you into form. And that's just kind of the sort of player that he's always been. Now, if you're not more talented than him, and if you can't hit him, you know, blow him away off the court with your skill set, you're going to have a lot of trouble beating him, and he's going to be a nightmare. But if you are the far superior tennis player, he's going to let you play well, essentially, RCB. And Djokovic certainly played really well. Now, because of my sleep schedule, and I need to ask you guys to kind of bear with me during this first week, because a lot of my viewership habits and all that depend on when I'm awake, when I'm sleeping and all that. I'm trying the best I can, but it is tough. I only saw the first set of Novak. And I think from everything I've seen, you can nitpick his level in some areas, but I don't think that's super important against those guys. And I've never been one to, put a microscope on the top players in the first couple rounds and, you know, critique their levels with any sort of, super critical eye. I don't think that's important. What I do think is important is that Djokovic showed that he's kind of turned the page mentally from just the utter flatness that we've seen from him at all times, or at some times, I should say. And he's done that. He's totally done that. I think he finally looks normal for maybe the first time all year, because at the Australian Open, I would point out that there are times where he played really, really good tennis, like against Fritz, for example. After the first couple sets, he played really, really good tennis. But even when that was happening, he still looked a little flat and low energy. And I feel like now he looks back to how he should look. He's expecting perfection out of himself every single point, maniacally. And that's what he does when he's at his best. He's bringing intensity to the court. And that's a massive positive right there. That's enormous. And that's, to me, by far the biggest takeaway for Djokovic through two rounds. I'm not doing this in any specific order, by the way. There was a totally shocking Khachanov loss. Jozef Kovalik threw to the third round of a major for the first time in his career. He comes back from down 2-0 against Karen Khachanov, who was 34-0 in his career after winning two sets, had made the second week at RG in 6 of his 7 main draw entries, and the one loss was to Kei Nishikori. Kovalik, lifetime against top 50 opponents, 3-21. Did have a big win against Cilic when Marin was a top 10 player. Upsets don't get much bigger than that. They really don't. Jannik Sinner, he beat Richard Gasquet, but for me it was a stock down match for my pick to win it all, as all of you know at this point. His tennis was good. I don't think I've ever seen Sinner hit so many drop shots, which made so much sense in the matchup. I thought the execution was good, but I think just the game plan coming onto court to hit a lot of drop shots was just really smart. Where Gasquet, he's not super quick, and he likes to position himself deep in the court, and the nighttime conditions were really cool and slow, and Sinner's ball, as a result, was not doing as much damage as it normally would. It was tough out there to get a lot of penetration. So Sinner did a great job of just kind of pushing Gasquet back, especially with the forehand cross court, and then hitting the drop shot cross court behind Gasquet's split step, and that play was money. I also think that Sinner made a great adjustment from the Eubanks match. There were times in the Eubanks match where Chris would throw up a higher, heavier ball, and it was just getting out of Sinner's strike zone. It was effective when Eubanks added height on the ball. And I think Sinner did a way better job against another guy with very heavy topspin and who puts a lot of shape on the ball, especially on the backhand. Gasquet actually has the heaviest topspin of any backhand on tour and has for a long time. He hugged the baseline and he took the ball on the rise to protect his strike zone. He was taking that heavy topspin nice and early. He was actually hitting a lot of leaping backhands where he would kind of jump off of his front foot and get a lot of leverage over the ball to make sure that it wasn't just like eating him up and getting up high on him. So all those things were good. The tennis was great. Why was it a stock down match for Sinner? Because there was a major physical wobble at the end. And as I have said, despite me before the tournament feeling like he was my pick to win, the physicality is the major concern coming in because he has a physical issue in the larger picture. I would refute that quite vehemently, but because the preparation has been compromised in a way that is actually more severe than we thought, because it's not just the hip, it's also that he was ill for about 3 weeks. So I don't know what happened, because I tried to look at the press conference, I Googled his name, and I tried to read stories, and I have not seen a single quote about what happened to Sinner physically at the end of the match. But I can tell you, he wasn't walking right. He was stretching out his calves. He was fighting for the points. He never started giving away return points or letting the effort level dip. So that, I guess, was a good sign. But ultimately, it felt like he slowed down significantly, and his serve saved him. Last couple service games, he just didn't need to play all that much. And he served miraculously well in his last couple service games. Even though it looked like his legs were weakened, which usually does affect the serve, and it seemed like Sinner, for some reason, was able to serve really well despite whatever was troubling him. I know he hit 3 service winners in the 5-4 game. And ultimately, that was key for Sinner escaping a match that ended up starting to feel pretty scary, because Gasquet, who's what, 37 or 38 now, looked fresher at the end of the third set. So that is worrisome, and I'll leave it at that. He has been allegedly, I'll say, not allegedly, he has said that he's been training with very high intensity on the off days because he's trying to make up for lost time. He's trying to build up his fitness very quickly. So maybe they took it a little too far after his first round match, and there was one day in between, he didn't get the Sunday start, which I think would have helped him probably. But maybe they took it a step too far and they trained so hard on the off day that he didn't come in with as much of a gas tank as he should have into the second round match against Gaz K. Next one, Holger Rune escapes against Flavio Cabali. Rune does things all the time that reminds you that he's just more talented than everyone else. And this was one of those moments. This one ends up going to a fifth set tiebreak, which Holger seems to constantly get himself into. And he goes down 5-love. Cabali's playing awesome, awesome tennis. I wouldn't have been, had Cabali pulled off the upset, I wouldn't have been too hard on Holger, particularly because my expectations for him, given the level of tennis that he has been playing, just wasn't all that high. And therefore, it wouldn't have been much of a letdown, I wouldn't say, against a Flavio Cabali who really impressed me. But at 5-love, he hits a first serve return on the ad side off of a serve with pretty solid pace. And I don't know exactly how fast it was, but it was a first serve. And Cabali, he doesn't massage the first serve unless he's kicking it, and then it's a nasty kick. But he didn't kick this one. He hit it hard. And Rune, on a stretch return off of his backhand, goes down the line, Mach 8. Cabali couldn't even move because the ball was already past him. So a first serve return winner on a redirected backhand down the line, which is, as far as degree of difficulty goes, the highest. It's a lot harder than, you know, the deuce side forehand return cross court, because at least you don't need, your timing doesn't need to be quite as perfect on that one because you're not changing direction. But this one, you have everything. He's stretched out. He's changing direction. He hits it a million miles per hour with like zero net clearance. It's just a total laser beam. It's one of the best returns I've ever seen. And that was just the start of what would be a couple more backhands down the line by Holger, which were equally impressive. There was a second serve return on the ad side again, where Cabali did hit his kick serve, which is a really, really good kick serve. And Rune moved towards it very aggressively to try to take it early on the rise before it kicked up too high on him. Still ends up being shoulder height. And he cranks it down the line for another winner. So that's two backhand down the line return winners. And then the last one in the tiebreak, and maybe I'll tell you what the score was when he hit this last one. It was 5-6. He's still down here. And he's still down the mini break, I believe. It might be on serve. I'm not sure. But this time, Cabali hits a heavy forehand inside-out approach shot. Rune is way backed up, back fence. And it's a spot where I would think what he should do is just try to dip a cross-court backhand pass low and start charging in to cover the drop volley. That would be probably the percentage play there. But not if you're Holger, because he hit another backhand down the line, open stance from 12 feet behind the baseline that thread the needle and landed perfectly inside the sideline for a clean pass winner. All of this was after going down 5-love in the tiebreak. As I mentioned, Rune ends up winning 10 of the last 12 points and wins that 10-point tiebreak. There's a weird thing in these 10-pointers where I genuinely feel like it's bad to take an early lead sometimes. And for Holger, there's been quite a weird pattern for him. I don't actually have it. I tried to get it in front of me. But for Rune, he's oftentimes, if you look at the history, gone up in these 10-pointers and then lost. And the one example that I will specifically recall is Andrei Rublev at the Australian Open last year. He was up 5-0 in the tiebreak, ended up losing it. And then this time he's down 5-0 in the tiebreak and comes back to win it. There's just so much time in these 10-pointers. And if you build an early lead like that, you start to get that finish line pressure. And it starts to hit you very early on. And there's just a lot of time for that finish line pressure to turn into an, oh shit, I blew the lead kind of thing. And then you absolutely do not have the momentum in the 10-point tiebreak. So that's kind of what I want to say. The backhand's down the line. There's like nobody in the world who can pull that off. Three low percentage attempts that, you know, Runa can make because he's Runa. And that's about it. You know, he just, his shot making, he does things all the time that break the rules. And this broke the rules because maybe you make one of those and maybe the second serve return just wasn't as exotic as the other two. But you don't make all three. You just don't. Unless you're like him and you're different. And then Caboli, a couple words on him. And I've struggled with him early on because it's been hard for me to tell what style of tennis he's trying to play. And as a result, I've kind of been like, what's going on there? What's happening? And I just didn't know quite what to make of him. I wasn't down on him. I just wasn't super high on him either. And I watched him enough today where I think I'm starting to put the pieces together, even though I still think it's hard to tell what style he's trying to play. At the end of the day, he's really fast around the court. He generates extremely well on his forehand and he serves well. And I don't know if there are three things that I can start a tennis player with if I want them to have success on tour, I'm probably giving them movement, a forehand, and a serve. So, and by the way, Caboli, it's not like he has those things and then the backhand is a clear weakness or he has no feel or his mental game is funky. Like, he has none of that stuff either. So everything else is fine and he has those three things really good. So ultimately, I'm very high on Flavio Caboli at this point now. I've determined that. And whoever is in charge at On Running of figuring out who to sign, I think they're doing a really good job. Fonseca, Caboli, Shelton, and then with the women, I guess they took a different strategy and just locked up Iga. Marozhan Dimitrov. This is the match I called this morning. And it came down to Grigor just having huge first serve potency, just really bombing his serve into the corners. Percentage be damned, because he was hovering around 50% first serves in throughout the match, but it worked. And ultimately, his serve profile was excellent. Because every time he made the first serve, not only was he usually winning the point, he was usually winning the point without having to rally. Dimitrov won 34 out of his 38 first serve points. The rally length stats were absurd. Rallies five shots or more was a plus one advantage for Dimitrov. So basically, after the first couple shots, this was an even match. This was a tight match. One through four shots, 28-point advantage for Grigor. That is why it was a very straightforward, straight set win for Dimitrov. He won the first nine games of this match as well. So he came out of the gates dominating. Marozhan, he really needs to serve better at 6'4". That was my big takeaway for him, because there's no way that he was going to win this match getting dominated in the serve return dynamic quite as much as he did. And for Grigor, it just sums up why he's so good right now. He racks up these easy points with his first serve in his forehand, even on slow clay. I just saw him do it. But at the same time, he isn't going to get crushed in rallies. He's going to hang in there. He's going to come up with some scrambles on return when you're going to kind of have to play some defense in order to have success. He contained Marozhan's drop shot. It felt like the drop shot was kind of a 50-50 proposition for Marozhan throughout the match. And if you're playing against him, that means you've done pretty well. And he killed Fabian coming forward. Fabian was not able to come forward and really finish points because Dimitrov had the answers each and every time. That'll do it for me. There's going to be one more episode of Tales from the Booth for third round. And then I will be shifting my coverage to a more normal schedule. Of course, Monday Match Analysis will be picking every single men's quarterfinal match. I'll probably bring a guest on for that one. Sometimes I do it by myself. Either one works. We'll see. But in a couple of days will be the third round edition of Tales from the Booth. I'll talk to you then. Hope you enjoyed. Don't forget to subscribe. I'll see you next time.
How about Cap'n Crunch's Crunch Berries with breakfast?
Whoa, Dad, we're on.
Crunch Island.
It's John LeFoot.
And he stole our crunch.
Quick, the zip line.
He's getting away.
Throw our last Crunch Berry.
No!
No one steals my Crunch Berries.
I think you mean my Crunch Berries.
Choose your own Crunch Venture with Cap'n Crunch.
She said, get out the chat room and clean my Glad stretch. Feeling fine, so fresh.
The Glad Girl Group coming at you with a throwback jam. That was Glad Force Flex Drawstring Trash Bags featuring Pine Sol Original Scent. And that's better than all good. It's all Glad.
When raising a Pacifico beer with friends you just met turns into hitting up their friend's local art show, getting inspired to create something together, and painting your first mural, you found what was waiting for you. Pacifico. Life's waiting. 21 plus only. Discover responsibly. Pacifico Clara Beer. Imported by Crown Imports, Chicago, Illinois.
Hey parents, Greenlight is here to take one big thing off your to-do list: teaching your kids about money. With a Greenlight debit card and money app of their own, kids and teens learn to earn, save, and invest. You can send money instantly, set flexible controls, and get real-time notifications of your kids' money activity. Set up chores and put allowance on autopilot to reward them for their hard work. Then, learn about the world of money together. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.